Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 279 of the Roguecast, recorded December 10th, 2019. I am the Ice Princess Sister.
We're back. We have been off for like a month.
Yes. And we're back with a special guest star, Anna.
Yes.
The staff.
Hi.
Y'all might know that Anna has podcasted before. When you and Kate and Julie did this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we had this weird schedule in mind where Nick was going to be off, and Max, our other staffer, was going to cover the front, and it was going to be me, Dave, and Anna. We were going to podcast for the week. Anna was excited. We were going to like all talk comics and stuff, and Anna doesn't get to get her voice heard on the podcast very much. And then the flu hit and destroyed everything.
Yes. And now we're in a weird place where Nick has returned.
Yes.
And we're going to try and manage to bounce people in and out of this podcast. It'll be seamless to you.
No, it won't be seamless to them.
But to us, it'll be a crazy musical chairs of people exiting and entering.
And that's what it's going to be like to the listeners as well.
All right. But it's going to be neat.
Yeah, it's going to be neat. It's going to be great.
Imagine a sort of a big Royal Rumble tag team match of a podcast.
Yeah.
Honestly, I was expecting you to talk up your editing skills more.
Oh, well, no, I have no editing skills.
Okay, yeah. Good. This won't be hard at all.
So what we're going to do is we're going to jump around a little bit more than we usually do. We're going to start, though, by talking about all the trailers that have dropped in the past week or two. So
Is there something going on that there's so many trailers?
The end of the millennium.
Okay, the end of our lifespan as a country.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes. The end of the Willennium. Will Smith's Willennium.
I had to be informed that this was an album.
The Willennium was an album.
And now I feel
Anna
like
knows because she's a millennial.
Yep, you know, that is true.
I feel like a bit of my soul has gone now that I know that.
All right, so in no particular order, we'll start with the one that I was kind of surprised and pleased to see, which is the Black Widow trailer. We've been waiting a while for this. It's sort of the first indication of what the post-Endgame Marvel Universe looks like.
And is it the first?
It is, but it's a flashback to pre-Endgame stuff.
Right. Out of curiosity, did the trailer make it? It didn't go out of its way to say this is a flashback movie, right?
No, they did not. No, at no point does she turn to the camera and say, "Hi, this is a flash. Hi, I'm Scarlett Johansson.
Well,
this is a flashback."
They didn't do it in the 1970s style of the doo-loo-loo, wavery screen.
No,
I was thinking more along the lines of like record scratch. Hi, it's me, Scarlett Johansson. I bet you're wondering how I got myself into this mess.
How am I not dead?
I think we talked about this when it was in the rumor stage, and the drum beat I've been sounding is, this doesn't hold a lot of interest for me.
And the drum beat I've been sounding is, no, Nick, this is never going to happen, and now Nick gets to hold this over me.
Yeah, that's true. Nick was, he's like, no, it's on the schedule, and you're like, it's not going to happen.
It's never going to happen, and it's going to happen.
But for me, it was just a matter of the fact that I think Scarlet Witch, Black Widow, and Hawkeye, maybe a few other characters that are kind of the lower tier power Avengers, I feel like if you drop them in a solo movie, then it's not so different from just any slightly heightened action movie, Fast and Furious-ish stuff. And I wasn't sure if it was going to come off, but I ended up kind of liking this trailer.
Interesting. And also, just a quick point, I would watch a Hawkeye-fronted Fast and Furious sequel.
Mm, okay.
Like, not Jeremy Renner. Hawkeye. Actually, Hawkeye.
Oh, okay. That I would watch. Anna, did you have thoughts on Black Widow?
Yeah. I mean, like you, I have almost no interest in it. I might have had interest in it in, like, you know, somewhere in the middle of the first chunk of the Marvel movies.
When they really need a female-fronted movie?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was, like, basically had written it off as something like, this is because they realized Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow is actually an untapped market that they haven't sold to yet when Captain Marvel sold so well. But actually seeing David Harbour and like the sort of like ensemble feel to the cast like actually made me a little excited for it.
Yeah, me too. There's nice little visual bits. The action looks great. Black Widow in a white costume is cool. The sort of Soviet tundra-esque look of the whole thing is fun. David Harbour's Red Guardian looks like a ton of fun.
Right?
He looks delightful.
I think when we were talking about it, I was saying that the thing that would make me interested way back when or whatever was if it's like kind of more firmly in the Marvel Universe, or they pick some interesting villains or allies or something like that, that makes it feel more Marvel-y to me and not generic action movie. And they did do that.
We got to look at Taskmaster.
Oh, I don't remember seeing that. I've only watched it once.
The guy pulling he's pulling a bow and he's got the like skull face. It's not a bad approximation of Taskmaster.
Are people going to be like Taskmaster?
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. He's not wearing like the gaudy colors and stuff.
I mean,
or
you're
the
right.
Buccaneer boots.
I wish he had buccaneer boots and a skull mask. You're not wrong, but he looks like a mercenary version. He looks like the military mercenary version of him, which
is
kind
like
of
what they did
with crossbones.
Crossbones, yeah.
Exactly that. Yes.
Yeah,
I like him using a bow and arrow, too, because that's a thing he does in the comics.
That is cool. I just would like more whimsy.
Who are you, and what have you done with Anna? What's your... The listeners do not know. Anna, what is your stance on buccaneer boots?
I think they look ugly.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think he should have buccaneer boots.
But you just said that you did.
No, I think he should have more whimsy.
Ah.
Like, I would like for him to, like, have the cloak and stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, look
something
a little
larger
more
than
like,
life.
Yeah.
Not a little bit so gritty military Marvel.
Yeah, I don't... I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of that aesthetic in general, which is part of the reason why Red Guardian, like, was what made me so interested in it, because he looks like a Marvel character.
Yeah, well,
let's get into one or two specifics, because I don't know who Red Guardian is, and I don't know... Or not really. And I don't really know... Who is the other woman? Who is the other...
It's Yelena. Well, they haven't actually named her, but it's Yelena Belova, the other Black Widow that Greg Rucka introduced.
Right. And was she... I'm trying to remember. Although I read that run, what I don't remember was she introduced when, like, Black Widow was thought dead? Was she introduced to replace
Natasha? She was Russia's
Natasha?
Replacement because Natasha had gone rogue and become a...
Right. Way back
superhero.
When she'd been become a superhero. Yeah,
and
okay.
She calls her Sis in this trailer. I don't know if she's actually going to be a sister or if it's going to be more
sister
of a, like...
training.
They raised in the Red Room together. Red Guardian is most easily explained as... Russia's Captain America.
Okay, that's fine.
And
they're doing an over the hill version.
Yeah,
as a little bit of Mr. Incredible.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I believe in the comics, I believe he was Natasha's husband who died.
Oh, weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they're doing something different here. I don't think he's going to be her old husband. I think he's going to be her like ex trainer father figure maybe.
You know, it's kind of funny for those who saw the ending of season 3 of Stranger Things. It's ironic that he would end up playing a Russian.
Yeah.
Are you saying this is a stealth Stranger Things sequel?
I think it probably is.
Yeah.
So is Ghostbusters.
Oh,
obviously.
My God. Stranger Things drops everything.
Anyway.
Wait, Wonder Woman 1984? That's got to tie in. It's in a mall.
It's in a mall.
Okay. Stranger Things ties into everything.
It's all coming together. Let's see if we can find the link between Stranger Things and every single other thing we talk about today.
Mission accepted.
I can't remember, Anna. Are you a Stranger Things follower, fan, non-follower, non-fan?
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
I'm not like a big fan of the whole like kids on bikes kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just in general, but yeah, I like it. It's fun.
So, but
have you seen all the seasons?
Yeah, I've seen
it. But rank it above or below Buccaneer Boots?
Oh, it's definitely above Buccaneer Boots.
Okay, good. All right. we don't know what it's about really, and I'm fine. It seems to be like. The past of the Red Room comes back to haunt them. Maybe they're training new people. Maybe Taskmaster's training Red Room. That would make sense. He's a trainer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool. I have always liked Taskmaster as a villain, and I assume that they're going to do the, photographic reflexes power of his for the big screen, which, if done right, could be pretty cool.
Yeah.
How do they explain that power? Photographic reflexes?
He sees anybody do anything and he can physically repeat it without any practice.
Oh, that's crazy cool, actually.
Yeah.
Like, he could watch Captain America do his coolest moves and he could instantly be able to do them.
So there's a fun story in the 80s where Taskmaster has to train John Walker, the replacement Captain America, on how to throw the shield.
Yeah.
The government gets him on a work release. They're like, look, we'll knock a few years off your sentence. Come train a new Cap because you're the only other man in the world who knows how to throw Captain America's shield. And he's like, look, I've isolated these 17 katas that he uses to throw a shield. I'm going to teach them to you. And he's like his drill sergeant. And that was cool.
That's kind of a neat idea.
Yeah.
I think the deal is, of course, always that the way that they can beat him is that whether, you know, he uses them in, you know, with the kind of intellect behind them of the character or their history is not quite there. It's almost like he takes a surface thing. But he is like, he can like duplicate all of Daredevil's moves, Spider-Man's acrobatics, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
It is. Moving on, we have the other big anticipated female-fronted action movie, Wonder Woman 1984.
Yep.
I loved this trailer.
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
I thought it was a nice music video for New Order.
It was a nice music video for New Order.
I liked it as well. I've been looking forward to this one. Although we're running the risk of making the 80s a little bit passé as far as the retro decade of choice these days. It's a fun trailer, and Wonder Woman, after rather the somewhat dour World War One setting,
yeah.
I kind of like the idea of a little glitz and glam.
She deserves to have some fun with her somehow mysteriously resurrected lover.
Yeah, the trailer doesn't say, but it's clear it's going to be something... She's, like, surprised in the trailer,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, so they're going to explain it. So, yeah, Steve Trevor is back. Who's the bad guy?
It's, so, I can't figure that out.
And I know because Nick blabbed it yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
There were two people
I just spotted
who,
on IMDb.
Yeah.
There were two people I thought it could be, and it was
neither
of them.
One of those people. But
so one of them was Dr. Psycho, because it looked like this guy looks like he's like some kind of creepy televangelist, used car salesman-y guy. Mm-hmm. He looks like all the people in the 80s did.
Yeah.
Anybody who was upper middle class or more.
It's true.
Anyway, I thought he was maybe Dr. Psycho. I thought he was maybe Glorious Godfrey from Jack Kirby's Fourth World setting.
Yeah, a little more off the beaten path, but would have
been
sense.
But in fact, he is...
Are we going to say?
I think it's an...
It's
known
Maxwell
thing.
Lord.
Yeah.
Played by Pedro Pascal. Do you know who that guy is?
I do, because we talked about it yesterday,
He's
but I've already forgotten.
He's the Mandalorian.
Yeah.
So he takes off his helmet and becomes a corporate raider in the 80s.
This is the way.
Oh, no.
The way is like Amway. This is the Amway. This is the way. And in 19 installments, you can be part of the way.
I did like the vibe he was given on the trailers. He looks like a fun villain.
Yeah.
Ares in the first one, maybe not as fun a villain.
No, he was not as fun. Also, Ares had a weird mustache, and that was strange.
When he... Yeah, like, in the comics, Ares in his armor looks cool.
Yeah.
Ares
in his armor with a mustache, not cool.
No.
Did they...
Oh, yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen
that.
At
the end, he, like, telekinetically brings the armor together, but he's still got the stash.
He looks like at any point he could say, tally-ho!
Yep. Yeah.
Well, that's fair. He's a little weird. I did like him in the suit, though.
Oh, sure.
I thought that was, like, a good sort of framing for...
I think I wish he had just kind of, like, they had replaced that actor with a dark, looming, Sauron-like, you know, CG...
Yeah.
He was mostly a CG concoction anyway at that point.
Yeah.
I would have just gone full monstrous... end boss from God of War style.
I wish they had used the technology that DC clearly has to remove his mustache. We know from Justice League they have mustache removal technology.
They're still working on it.
Alternatively, he could have like a Sailor Scout style, like he's spinning around in lights everywhere and he's just shaving real fast.
I love it. Yeah.
That's part of his transformation into Ares.
I think that like Henry Cavill, he had in his contract, I will not shave my mustache. I will put the armor on around my mustache.
Yeah.
And they're like, this guy is such a powerhouse character actor, whoever he is, that we just have to do it. So, you know, the other thing that kind of stood out about this trailer is there's little glimpses of lots of cool action sequences.
Yep.
And she's like doing all kinds of cool stuff with the lasso you don't normally see.
She's fighting in a mall.
But she like used it like almost like as like this shock ram sort of thing, where it's like the shock waves of it like hitting people was like knocking people around.
She's knocking a bullet back at people.
Yep.
She's swinging on lightning.
That was a big thing too. She's what do you call it? Metallica style.
Yeah.
She's riding
lightning.
Yep. What was the It didn't. I'm sure she's got to throw it at some point, right?
She throws her tiara and like takes out the cameras.
That was what it was. Oh,
I don't think I noticed that.
Yeah,
when is that?
It's in the mall. She like throws her tiara and takes out the cameras, so presumably so that she can kill the bad guys without being taped with body cam style. Because that's Wonder Woman style.
That's an interesting notion, Randy. I don't know if that's actually necessarily going to happen.
No, I'm pretty sure that's it.
This is an action movie set in the 80s.
Right. So she's got to be a super cop.
Yeah. Got it.
I'm really looking forward to seeing how they advance the character, because she will have been around for, 70 years at this point.
Yeah, I assume they're not saying she went into, like, hibernation or, like, some mystic sleep or went back to Paradise Island or whatever, but that she has actually been in and around that whole time.
But Paradise Island is still going to be in this. We do see that a little bit of
the
that.
The Amazons and stuff.
Yeah, which is cool.
There's a little baby girl Amazon.
The baby girl Amazon.
But also to mention, even though it's only glimpsed the cheetah,
yeah,
aka, what's, it's, mm-hmm. yeah, she's clearly it looks like she's gal pals with yeah. Wonder Woman early on. They're like Start having with. Drinks and...
I felt like she was interviewing
okay.
her.
Oh, okay.
I thought maybe she was like a journalist or something.
That could,
instead
that could
of an archaeologist. Or she could be an archaeologist, and since Diana Prince works in antiquities, mm-hmm. it could be that. She could be interviewing her on that basis.
Do you think, Randy? Like, right while they're talking, like, this cheetah will just leap out and bite her? And, like, she'll get its cheetah powers?
And she's like, well, criminals are a cowardly and superstitious lot. I shall become a cheetah.
I shall become whatever the first thing is that bites me. And then they were just about to order some more drinks, and a cheetah
and
lunched
cheetah
at her.
Lunched at her. Like, yeah, that's how it would have happened in the '60s, Dave.
Yeah, that's
but not
true.
the '80s.
But I don't know. I got a good vibe off of her.
Me too. I'm excited for it, Anna.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really excited for it.
There was one shot of her like walking out somewhere where it looks like she was sort of glammed up for like a party or something like that, and
oh,
she
yeah.
looked like she was kind of like, I'm in charge now.
Yep.
And I don't know if this is sort of one of those, after she gets the power, she goes from being sort of mild-mannered to assertive, but...
I think that's probably what's going on, yeah.
Yeah, I think an initial impression is that I think she's going to do a good job at it.
Well, if Maxwell Lord is doing some kind of wish fulfillment thing, that could tie into why Trevor's back, and it may be like a tragic thing.
That was something I considered, was the... Like, if after all was said and done, he's not actually even alive.
Yeah.
Like, it's like an implant to, like, take
oh,
something
no.
horrible away from Wonder
That'd
Woman
be
after
mean.
That.
Well, yeah. Didn't you say he also has, like, some low-level psychic powers that can push
that's,
people
that's
towards
his thing?
Them.
Yeah.
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 So.
Yeah, I presume he's, like, doing some kind of, yeah, new agey thing or televangelism or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what his scam will be.
It's interesting, because Maxwell Lord is a major character in the Supergirl show. Thinking about it, he was their weird fake Lex Luthor in some ways.
Yeah. Right. I don't know what became of him, because I only saw like a season
I
and a half or two.
I think the actor left the show and they just kind of dropped him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He got Maxwell bored.
That said, I do hope that the Wonder Woman movie isn't more dark, given that, like, I think isn't DC cinematically at least trying to move away from the Snyder tone?
Overall,
yes.
There's still some weirdness, though, because Joker came out.
Yep.
And,
Wait, Joker's gay?
Can't you tell? I mean, my gaydar isn't the best, but
Dave just thinks
you know Harley Quinn
gay.
Is. You know Harley Quinn is a beard.
Yeah.
This conversation took the strangest turn.
It did.
What I was going to say was that at the very least, I know that the Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey movie is also like carrying an R rating and is going to be kind of a, if not darker. Well, it'll be darker in its way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think that an R rating necessarily requires it to be darker. I mean, I don't think Deadpool is super dark in spite
of its
not. R rating. But
it,
like,
it just has humor for the big boys, which is really humor for the little boys.
Yes, yeah, little boys live inside of big boys. All right. So let's move on to Ghostbusters Afterlife, which Anna and I have already discussed in depth outside the podcast.
I was trying to stop y'all. I was like, save it for the podcast!
Yeah, but we wanted to talk about the larger cultural ramifications of the Ghostbusters
That's
Afterlife
true.
And all that,
That's
which
true.
Is sort of outside the scope, but just very quickly. There is definitely, I think, a camp that Anna is more strongly in than I am, although I totally see the point, of that this Ghostbusters Afterlife, to some extent, feels like a response to all the people who didn't like the Ghostbusters 2016 and are in a very toxic way.
Yeah.
What did you say?
Oh, absolutely. It's weird because... Wow, now I can't talk. it's super weird because, like, it's hard to deny that it was not as commercially successful as they wanted it to be.
Right.
And so... With that in mind, like, you do have a point that, like, because their goal is, as a company and creating a franchise, to protect that brand by trying to cultivate the good aspects of that brand.
Right.
But it's hard not to notice the connective thread there.
Right. And like, they don't care about... It feels like they're telling you, we don't care about the creative integrity of the franchise. We
yes.
just care about the commercial integrity of the franchise.
And nor do they care, it seems, about the, like, cultural ramifications of doing such
right.
a thing.
Right,
it is,
right. That they're handing a victory to kind of
the
obnoxious,
worst in the
incel-y, alt-righty
yeah.
fan community.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would argue that Ghostbusters 2016 never got the chance to stand on its own
it
without those criticisms. They were there from the moment the first trailer hit.
You're not wrong. And the funny thing is, like, I don't think Dave or I consider himself a big fan of that movie.
Yeah, I liked bits and pieces, but it didn't land for me. I guess I liked,
but didn't love it. You liked it better of the three of us. You liked it much more of the three of us than the And I know Nick really likes it.
I watched Ghostbusters when I was a kid, but I would hardly say that I felt like it was a franchise that I related to or was super interested in. And this is the first time that like I really felt like I don't want to say catered to, because catered to is the wrong word, and I don't think that the other Ghostbusters movies catered to men specifically.
But they
I mean, they did. Like, I don't want to say it, but the humor's...
Bro?
Yeah, it's like bro-y.
I mean, it was Saturday Night Live, National Lampoon type. Yeah, for sure.
But, like, this movie, like, it has a similar vibe. Like, the gags are all basically the same. Yeah. I mean, the cast is Saturday Night Live alumni, right? Yeah. So, it's... I don't know, but it felt specifically like that was, I guess, more relatable to me.
Yeah,
I get that. See it so swiftly, like...
Well, if nothing else... Although you could argue that, like, the concept is nostalgic, it wasn't a nostalgia piece the way I feel like Ghostbusters 2 was, which was just kind of trying to say, hey, remember Ghostbusters? We do.
Yeah. We don't remember the specifics, so here's the thing with the Statue of Liberty and some goo.
Yeah. that's actually my usual solution when I'm, like, working on a creative project and I don't know where to take it.
Yeah.
Statue of Liberty and goo.
Yeah, it's weird. Nice. Your Matrix 2 pitch was Statue of Liberty and goo, I thought was really good.
They kept some of the goo for those Liberty. Yeah.
They're like, how about goo and an orgy? What do you think about that?
Acceptable.
Wait, did that happen in Ghostbusters 2?
You know how they have the ghost blowjob scene in the first one?
Yeah.
Well, they just accelerate that for the second one.
Interesting.
A big ghost orgy with Egon.
Just a big he slimed me sequence.
So that's where all the kids in the trailer came from.
So that said,
yeah, at some point we should discuss the actual trailer.
Yeah.
I will say this, by the way, broadly speaking, in sort of a the way Hollywood seems to work is when they if it's not done by like sort of an indie director who actually really has like a vision or something like that. Not that you have to be indie to have a vision, but a lot of times if something is progressive as far as its thinking. It's either inadvertent or more almost because they think they can make a buck off of it at that point.
For sure.
And that is kind of... It's unfortunate, it's the world we live in.
Yeah.
I just wish there were more people willing to put aside that very mercenary attitude.
Yeah.
To be like, we did this, you may not have liked it, but we did it, and it was right.
Yeah.
I do think there are filmmakers who do that at times. So I think...
Not to give George Lucas anything, but George Lucas. But
about the trailer itself, though, I like Jason Reitman. I've liked his movies Up in the Air, Thank You for Smoking, I think a couple others. I like his movies in general.
Hmm.
And I like Paul Rudd. Everybody likes Paul Rudd.
Right?
It's actually illegal to dislike Paul
Rudd.
It
is, yeah. He will come to your house and beat you to death with a hammer.
No, someone else will, because Paul Rudd's a nice guy.
He would never do that. order it cold-bloodedly while drinking a martini.
I'm looking slightly bewildered because, I don't remember that Paul Rudd was in it.
Yeah, he's like the teacher in this.
I only saw, like, kids running around, and I was like, this is Stranger Things by way of Tremors, by way of Ghostbusters.
And that was the thing. I was not expecting this energy. This does not feel like Ghostbusters.
Right, well, they didn't do all the gags and stuff.
Well, and it starts with, like, it's this kid... And it's in this, like, small town, and nobody's...
And we're talking, like, a small, small town.
Nobody's heard of Ghostbusters. There's one, like, they're starting to have, like, what looks like earthquakes, and their science teacher, played by Paul Rudd, is starting to notice this stuff.
Right.
And it seems like it is ghosts are popping up. There have been no ghosts in, like, 30 years. Everybody's forgotten the Ghostbusters existed because it was all in New York City.
Yeah.
And...
I actually kind of liked that idea.
I love the idea of it. People are already pushing back, saying, well, of course they would still remember the ghosts. This is a big thing. They, like, almost blew up the Empire State Building or whatever. I'm like, but you know what? Like, big things get forgotten all the time. I bet if you ask a lot of modern kids about, like, the World Trade Center bombing...
Yeah.
Of, like, by Timothy McVeigh and all that stuff, they would know nothing about
that. It is sadly...
Yeah. Children, though, I guess.
It is
but
sadly...
I guess that's who they were
that's
talking
who they, that's
to.
That's who it is.
So
it's like teenage.
Like,
yeah, it's like teenage.
Now we're much farther out from it, but the grim truth is that, like, the Holocaust is in danger of being, if not forgotten, muddled by, white supremacists and stuff.
Right. Slimer was an inside job.
Yeah. Not my white supremacists, but anti-Semites.
Yeah.
So, so I actually do buy something that was like, 40-ish years ago?
Yeah.
That could happen.
Yeah. So, and it's enough for me to buy into.
Yeah.
And I like...
Also, if the ghosts haven't been a problem since.
I like the tone is different, And yeah, it's basically
it's kind of
like
eerie.
All these kids start to discover, oh, wait a minute, one of my granddads was maybe one of the Ghostbusters. It looks like probably it was Egon.
Right.
Oh, that could be a misdirect.
Right, I did think about that. When you said that the timeline didn't work for Egon to have a grandson, I was like, I wonder if it's possible it's not exactly what it looks like.
He could have just, I mean, his kid could have had her kid really young.
Are we thinking it's Egon because of the hair?
It's because the jumpsuit says Spengler.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And also because Harold Ramis died, and that's probably a nod to him. But what if it's baby Oscar from Ghostbusters 2? it's Dana's baby.
Well, you could...
That was actually what I thought at first. Yeah. Or, like, that it could have been.
But then he would have had to have a kid when he was, like, 16.
Oh, wait.
Or something like that.
Why? How old was...
Because it's been, like, 35 years.
How old was he in the first movie?
Who, baby Oscar?
No, wait, what? No.
Egon. Egon in the first movie.
Yes, Egon. I mean, he could have had a kid immediately after those two movies, and then in the 30 years, his...
But then his... Yeah, his
kid... could have had a kid, and
his
then
his kid
that
would have
kid
had to have a kid at, like, 15 or 16 to have a kid... have a teenage grandparent.
Well, they're going to have a bit of a stealth movie about teen sex and the risks of unprotected sex.
Yeah, okay. Well, that ties into the ghost orgy from 2.
Well, how old are the kids? They look probably like 10 or 12, right?
I don't know. I think they're in their teens. I mean, Finn Wolfhard is probably in his 20s now or something.
Okay, but, like, isn't he playing, like, an 8-year-old on Stranger Things? So, like...
I thought they're all, like, 14 or 15.
Look, how old is Tom Holland? And he's playing, like, high schooler Peter Parker.
Tom Holland is actually 73. He just looks really young.
Damn, he aged so well.
Yeah, he's in such good shape.
Hey, and what did you think about, like, the tone of it? Like, were you interested, or does it matter to you, like, if Ghostbusters kind of veers into, well, by the end of it, I guess it does, has more of a fun vibe.
Yeah.
But it kind of is a little more, like,
mystery.
I don't know, eerie mystery, yeah, early on.
I mean, it seems like the trailer, like, laid things out in a way that I thought was maybe a little reverent for a movie that features a ghost blowjob.
Right.
But
I can see that.
You know what, though? I agree with that, but I actually like that reverence. I like the sort of the... it's because it's not the movie is something sacrosanct, but it was this big thing for a lot of people. Just did the Netflix show, The Movies That Made Us, and Ghostbusters is one of them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a big thing. I saw it when I was, 13 or 14 years old, and it looms large for me. And the notion of sort of this treating it like a cultural artifact inside its own world is a little weird, but I also kind of liked it.
Hmm.
You know, see what I'm saying? I totally get what you're saying. It's like, it is ridiculous that they're like, oh, the legacy of the Ghostbusters, these goofballs who blew up a hotel. Like, it is silly. I get it. But I also kind of like it on sort of a meta level.
They were the only ones who dared to stand up to the EPA.
Yes, it was the
80s. Watch them end up co-opted by the alt-right, too.
Oh, God.
I guess it's too late after that last Ghostbusters.
After 2016, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, the other thing is that, like, while it does have, like, a bit of a tonal disparity...
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that's bad.
Yeah.
I just went into the saying that, like, I thought that the movies were, like, a little bro-y.
Yeah.
And that was not a great thing for me.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
So it's possible that, like, this will do better. I mean...
Yeah. It does look like it's an ensemble thing with kids instead of Ghostbusters, and they eventually get to bust out with the Ecto-1, and they're driving around in cornfields tearing it up, and they got a cool little door gun thing with an Ecto-cannon on it.
That's the thing I wish I didn't know. I wish I would have seen that in context.
Yeah,
that was the one
you
were talking about the other day.
Because that was cool, but I really would have liked to have seen that in context.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But seeing the Ecto, when they pull up the thing and they see the Ecto-1, I was like, I got a little, not choked up, but like, I was, oh, that's a cool bit. Like, they got me in several places. Yeah.
And this might just be like the thing that you watched the movie when you were a kid, but when I saw it, I was like,
You're rolling your eyes, yeah. And that is the thing. It's got its hooks in the nostalgia centers of me.
Yeah.
And my cynicism does not get deep into that
well, yeah,
place.
It's like a version of, like, I think a lot of people, the most common thread through a lot of us is probably Star Wars.
Yeah.
When they play that, like, sort of mysterious music for, like, that was Luke looking at the twin sons, it's hard not to sort of feel pulled into it.
Yep.
No matter, like, how, even if you've, like, really disliked some of the Star Wars here and there, you hear some of that once stuff from the magical, from the earliest ones, and you're like,
if you play that,
the dream.
If you play that, like, John Williams theme in the background, that little bit, while Bruce Willis comes on screen and stares at me and says, "You, Randy Lynn, are a piece of shit," I'm still going to get a little choked up. That's just, the music has that effect.
Very specific.
I've had dreams. And also a spec script.
Wild.
So, anyway.
When is this movie coming out?
Next summer.
Interesting.
I think all this stuff is next summer. Let's move on to Disney's Mulan, a movie I have no nostalgic attachment for because it is a weird gap in my Disney. I've never seen it.
It's
That's
pretty good.
Bonkers.
I know
to
that
me.
Eddie Murphy's a dragon.
Yep.
And also that he's in that movie as a dragon.
But he's not in the live action one because it's more Crouching Tiger than Disney.
Yes, more Crouching Tiger, less Hidden Dragon.
Yeah.
No, the dragon is very hidden.
Dragon is super hidden.
So hidden, not in the movie. they made a clear decision at some point to, there's different degrees of fidelity in these adaptations. I was thinking, when they did the Jungle Book live action,
that one
they kind of rebuilt from the ground up.
Yeah.
And I thought did a very good job, and I love the original Jungle Book.
And Lion King is nearly shot for shot, and that was...
And that wasn't so good.
Great.
But were talking about Aladdin earlier, and I quite liked their remake of Aladdin.
Me too.
It was pretty close to it, but they expanded on it, and I thought kind of... The few expansions they did I thought were fun.
But they took out the music.
In Mulan?
In Mulan.
Oh. Yeah.
This one looks like wildly different.
Oh yeah, it bears like zero resemblance.
I mean,
like,
other than the
names are
the
all
plot
changed.
Point. It's based on a historical.
It is
figure that has gone through the sort of the time, the legend of time.
Well, not all the names are changed. Mulan remains the same.
I mean, yeah, just her. She's the only one.
But I'm sure that like the guy who's like the trainer guy.
No, different.
Different name?
Yeah. He's not Shang anymore.
Oh, really? Are they going with like a more historical name?
I think probably. At least I'm pretty sure he's not Shang anymore.
I don't know. Look it up.
I gotta know.
You keep talking and I'll find it.
Okay.
So, the vibe is serious, sort of fantasy period piece movie in the style of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. In general, interest? No interest?
Not really. I mean, it doesn't... That in and of itself doesn't feel like a Disney movie to me, mm-hmm. and it certainly doesn't feel like Disney's Mulan.
Would you be, if Disney's name were taken off this, and someone just said, I'm doing a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon-style version of the Mulan legend, would that hold any interest? I guess part of it is, do you like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon-type stuff?
I do. I mean, like, I like crazy kung fu fights and stuff.
Yeah.
If the expectations of this is their remake of their animated movie was not there, is this something you would like as a standalone?
I don't know. Like, I don't know if I need the cut and dry version of Mulan or even like the heightened version of Mulan.
Well, I mean, arguably Disney's was already heightened as the original legend probably included less Broadway numbers.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Ancient China was full of Broadway numbers. That's where Broadway comes from. It's a Chinese word meaning lots of lights and theater.
And sassy Eddie Murphy was a staple of all the dramas of the
time. If you go to China, and I haven't been, but our friend Dan's been, and he hasn't said this, but I feel like it's in his eyes.
Yeah, oh.
That Eddie Murphy statues everywhere. Are everywhere. In China. And if I'm wrong, may Dan just contradict me right now. No, nothing. I'm clearly right.
It's a good tracks. Point.
Shen Lang? Is that
no.
the name of it? No.
Shang is his
Shang.
Last
okay,
name.
No, there's no Shang.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is
it spelled like with a TS?
No.
Like Cheng?
It's Xian.
Yeah.
I guess it could be pronounced Xian, but I think it's Shen.
Yeah.
Xian.
So I like the period piece stuff. I like that director who also made Ang Lee made Crouching Tiger. I can't remember if the guy making I don't know who's making this actually or who's directing it. But I like other movies like Hero, House of Flying Daggers. What was that more recent one? Shadow was really cool.
It's that person?
No, I don't think it is. But I think it's emulating all of those ones.
Yeah.
And actually, although I don't know if I saw like wild wild wire foo stuff.
It is being directed by. The New Zealand director of Whale Rider and The Zookeeper's Wife.
Weird.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
That's the movie that had Matt Damon in it, right?
New Zookeeper's Wife? No, you're thinking of We Bought a Zoo.
Oh.
Different. Very different.
Weird.
This looks more like she makes sort of arty films.
Oh.
That sounds right.
But here's the thing. This is something that's interesting, as I noticed. Everything we just talked about, three of the four movies we just talked about, female directors.
That is good.
Black Widow and Wonder Woman, there's going to be two big, and Mulan, that's three big action movies starring female stars, directed by female directors. That's really notable and a step in the right direction, at least.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it does make me feel a little worse about complaining about Ghostbusters. But...
That's the dude directing that one. You can say all you want about that.
Yeah, but when I say stuff like, it feels bad to see, like, the sort of, like, great diversity that we had been seeing for a long right. time, like in comics and media, yeah. like gets sort of like rolled back gently. Like it does feel bad, but at the same time, like you're right, there are three major action movies, yeah. two of which from the largest like media yeah. company
which
in
is,
the world,
which is
all
great.
Directed by
yeah.
women.
Which is great, but it's still not enough. Let's be honest.
You're not wrong.
Speaking on political topics that relate to this. Although I do, I thought that was a good trailer. Like I wanted to be enthused about it, but I didn't end up sharing the trailer in the social media because I was like, "Oh yeah, the lead actress spoke out in favor of the Hong Kong authorities, police, government, and the police, and therefore against the pro-democracy protesters," and it was just. A, I'm surprised Disney didn't shut that down. But B, I'm like, that is just so disheartening because her voice is going to carry weight. She's literally, it's like the person playing, you know, Abraham Lincoln in a movie making a point about like, you know, I'm taking a stance for Blue Lives Matter or something like that. And then you're like, right before Lincoln comes out and you're like, oh, I'm not 100% sure I want to get behind this.
But also, I'm not surprised that Disney didn't put a stop to it.
Yeah, that may be.
I can't imagine that China is a small part of Disney's marketing.
That's true. I've always liked that Disney at least had a reputation, again, although I know it's them just trying to get a buck, but they were their parks and stuff were LGBT-friendly at a time when that wasn't very common.
Right, yeah. They're big enough that they shouldn't... If anyone doesn't have a kowtow to China and the other way around, it should be Disney.
Yeah.
Disney can be like, yeah, sure, cut your citizens off. You're going to find out that they want democracy sudden because they want Disney back. Like, they could really... They could actually throw their weight around a little bit and be a good corporate citizen.
I wish they would.
Yeah.
Because if they would, then they wouldn't have had to wait... you know, 25 Marvel movies to give us gay characters or anything like that. And then still to like tiptoe around it.
Yes.
Like
it's pretty sad.
It is.
Your activism doesn't count if you won't toe the line for like what you believe in.
Yeah. I agree.
What else we got?
So let's jump over from trailers. We'll cover a few more with Nick in a bit. Let's talk Frozen 2. Speaking of Disney. And juggernauts.
Right.
Now, Anna, you've not seen Frozen. despite my attempts to show it to you in the store.
Uh-huh.
You don't know Let It Go the way we all know Let It Go.
No.
Yeah.
I've never seen Frozen.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, what's your general, like, I know you like Mulan.
Yeah.
Do you like Disney movies in general, like their animated features?
Weirdly, I mean, I haven't liked a lot of their 3D animated ones.
Uh-huh.
Like, I like Brave. I think Brave is
great.
Brave
is really good.
It looks great. Yeah. It's super fun. I don't want to sound like a hipster, but, like, I think that there is, like, a quality to, like, a lot of the older Disney animated movies that, like, creates a... Like, it creates something that feels very Disney, and it mm-hmm. could just be because that was the style that they used for their animated features when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these movies, they don't have that same thing.
Do you feel like they're more homogenized?
Or... I mean, I don't know if I, like, have enough of an opinion about a lot of the modern movies, because mm-hmm. I think I've basically seen a couple of them, maybe once or twice.
That's fair.
But yeah, it feels very different.
But you have some Disney fandom in you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I actually love Mulan. It's one of my favorite movies.
Okay.
And I think that the animated version does some really cool things with an animated movie that are really surprising.
Well,
but,
you know, Frozen, one of the things that I maybe gets a little forgotten in the just being just pounded it away by the ubiquitousness of Let It Go is that it did some subversive things by having... sisters as a lead by subverting their own trope by having one of them fall in love with somebody, be told, hey, it's a bad idea to marry this guy you just met.
Yeah, and then the handsome prince turns out to be the bad guy.
And is the scumbag. And then there's also, they didn't go to bat with the, although there is a relationship that develops in it.
The true love is between the sisters.
The true love is between the sisters. And so they subverted some tropes, interestingly. And that said, it's still about a monarchist family that needs to be overthrown.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing. I didn't think there was anywhere to go with Frozen 2. I wanted to see it just out of curiosity, but I wasn't sure that I needed more of this world.
Yeah.
And I thought what they did with Frozen 2 was a nice, ambitious scaling. Like, it wasn't the same story over again.
Right.
And they were they touched on the same sort of thing. It's sort of about how a monarchist regime dealt with an indigenous peoples.
Right. This was actually something where I thought that they were moving to a very bold thing to do in there, and then they pulled back a little bit at the end.
They did give
you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do exactly what you're talking about.
And I was so ready for the I'm gonna say wipe the slate clean approach that I thought was gonna happen, and I was like, damn, this movie's gonna kick ass.
Yeah,
and they kind of tried to find a middle centrist ground.
They let the superpowers save the day in a way. And we should probably say that we're going to spoil Frozen 2 a little bit here.
You already have.
Yeah, well, although I don't think... we were talking in such broad strokes. Yeah,
but
That said, we both liked it.
Right? I liked it quite a bit. I thought that having them...
You say it's a slightly darker movie?
It is a slightly darker movie. I mean, there's a bit where Olaf looks out at the audience and says, you all look a little older, too. Like, he is there. They very much acknowledge... Oh, this is for kids who have had like 5 years since they saw Frozen.
Is that when they're doing the song
God,
about
it been that long ago?
It's been a few years. Yeah.
Is that when they're doing the song about how things are? He's singing about how everything is the same or whatever, but everything is clearly changing.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually really liked that. It was kind of a little melancholy and yet somehow up tempo.
I liked all the songs. I thought the '80s power ballad was probably my favorite bit.
Which one are you speaking of?
Kristoff. Who is singing his song, and it's like he's
pining for Anna. He wants to pop the question to her now that they've been together for quite some
time. This is a power ballad?
It is done like 80s power, but like they do a thing where he's singing and they show his like feathered hair and like a big picture big head of him like next to him singing. He walks up to like this pine cone, it's like the microphone, like
that's incredible.
They're riffing on 80s power ballads. I was dying. One of my friends saw it with her kids and she was dying, and she's like, my kids are not laughing because they do not know what's going on. I am dying about how good this is.
The song I most liked, I think, was the was Anna's very sad song near the end.
Oh really?
Things Are Looking Bleak song.
Yeah, yeah.
That said, just as a real quick plot thing, the sisters get swept off to this mysterious northern land.
Yep.
And I will say the truth. I don't know whether, like, are they from, are they in, like, Scandinavia?
It's definitely a Scandinavia type.
I forget what it is, but it's, like, it's pretty specific because they use the artwork and stuff. Like, I think it's, like, literally, it's, like, the year 1572 in Scandinavia or wherever.
Right.
Were there indigenous people to the north in real life?
I don't know.
Because they make it almost sound like it's the land of, like, the Fey lands. Yeah. Like they have magic is absolutely a thing here.
Yeah.
And they're drawn there by these, for mysterious reasons, but it clearly may have to do with saving the town or not.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of a dark stain of something from their past history from, was it Arendelle, I think is where they come from. That they have to deal with before it's all said and done. And this place has, like, big giant stone giants that are, like, super tall. Like, 100 feet tall.
Their elementals are cool.
Yeah, they were cool. And then there's other sort of spirits of sort of the elements. A little bit of fifth element, earth, wind, fire, and a mysterious fifth element.
Yes. I thought the visuals were really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the songs. It's not at the level of the songs. All the songs at Frozen are really catchy.
Right.
This one is not as instantly like memorable as the others, but they're all good.
Right. And in a way, I kind of like that. I feel like they all fit. I mean, they all slotted in very nicely into the storyline.
Out of curiosity.
Yeah.
One, feel free to cut this joke if it's stupid, but is Bruce Willis the mysterious fifth element?
No, it's Lilu.
Okay, that works too. Secondly, in years past, sequels to Disney movies have gone directly to DVD.
Oh, yeah.
Is this... And I'm not saying that those sequels are bad. I guess that they just assumed that they wouldn't have as big of a theater draw.
And most of them aren't. Most of them are not great.
Yeah. Is this movie past Disney sequel quality?
No,
or is this like Toy Story 3?
It's closer to Toy Story. It's not as good as the Toy Story sequels, which I hold up as the best of the Pixar sequels.
Okay.
But it's closer to that.
I think I'd agree.
It is a worthy sequel.
It is for sure a lot of thought was put into it, and it's very compelling. I think it's just not quite like Toy Story 2 and probably 3, if I ever get around to watching that.
And 4, Dave, there's a fourth movie. You still haven't seen 3.
Oh my god, there's a fourth Toy Story movie?
And it's good. I know, it doesn't
happen
seem like
in the last
be.
Year.
Oh my god.
Those are pretty close to perfect sequels.
Yes.
Like it's maybe almost an unfair standard to try and compare something to that.
It's true.
What I like is that this gets to be a sequel without, in some ways, without trying to be as extra as the first one was.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's definitely worth checking out if you were at all a fan of the original Frozen, and if you kind of wanted to see Frozen maybe with a slightly darker turn to it, and slightly actually fewer earworm music, then that's a bonus too.
Yeah. Is the voice cast all the same from the first movie?
Yep. It's got Kristen Bell, Idina Menzel, okay. Jonathan Groff. I forget who all else is in it.
It's, yeah, like the whole ensemble of the core quartet.
And Josh Gad as Olaf, of course.
Dumb snowman, right?
Yes.
Oh, he's good.
He's 5'4". Now, did you know that?
That's a which thing.
I guess would make them giants.
They're all correct. Giants, yes.
However, I don't like the little snowman.
Well, you don't even know the little snowman.
I know enough.
He likes you.
He shouldn't.
He wrote me a note and said he thinks Anna is... Oh, he met Anna in the movie.
Yeah, he got us mixed up, yeah.
You know, the funniest thing to me was that
in this
one... Do you
not have an ice princess sister?
No, I am the ice princess sister.
Oh, okay.
In this one, Olaf... actually, he's always been used for surprisingly weird dark humor. His hilarious song in the first one was about how he's pining for summer, and he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he just knows it's going to be the best time for him, and he's going to see what happens to ice in the great in heat.
Yeah, one of the good jokes is that Kristoff is like, I'm going to tell him, and she's like, don't you dare.
And in this one, he has like all these jokes about like death.
Yes.
Like constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you're saying is he's the millennial audience character.
Oh, yeah.
I suppose
his,
so, yeah.
Weird fatalist humor.
Yeah, probably. There may be something to that.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of December 10th, 2019. We might throw in a couple from last week or two. We haven't had a chance to talk about
it.
It was
a puffy week this week.
It was a puffy week.
There were many comics.
So, Anna, you're our guest. Why don't you start with your pick for the week?
Oh, my pick for the week?
Yes.
I'm gonna pick Far Sector.
Yep.
On the DC's Young Animal line.
Yep. Second issue, right?
Yeah, it is a second issue. So I mean, I guess you would have to read the first one if you did want to read this one, though.
No,
it does,
you can jump right in.
Well, I mean, it encapsulates what happened in the
it
first one.
It actually does, surprisingly. So, tell us the basic premise though of the book.
But the basic premise is the main character, who I don't think they have named.
They have.
Her name is Sojourner. Sojourner?
Sojourner, yeah.
Sojourner, that's it.
I know, no doubt or not.
I don't know.
A nod to Sojourner Truth, the historical figure.
This one is, yes. Sojourner, but she's Sojourner Fiction.
Yes.
Get the F out.
Sojourner Ixon?
I was trying to get the elevator pitch real quick here.
Well, she's like the sheriff of a far, like a frontier town, basically.
Yeah, Green Lantern.
Yes, a Green Lantern sheriff of a frontier town. A space frontier town. And it doesn't really play out like a Western. It plays out more noir-y.
Yeah, for sure.
It's also a part of DC's Young Animal line, which just means it has a different vibe than the average Green Lantern book.
Yeah.
It's a little less superhero and honestly a little more sci-fi.
Yeah, it's actually super weird, but I would argue not in a way that comes off as trying too hard,
mm-hmm.
like a lot of writers are when they're trying to be too weird. But it's...
Right, it's not like Doom Patrol,
it's not kooky, it's just strange.
Right.
And when I say strange, I mean like mysterious.
Right, it seems like it kind of wants to push some big sci-fi concepts and stuff in there. Like,
it's very high concept.
Yeah, there's... Because the... Well, what's the nature of the mystery in it?
So the people on this planet... they have, like, an emotion inhibitor in place because they have evolved from something with baser, more violent instincts.
Yep.
And as a result of this, they have not had a murder in forever. And
right.
She is investigating the first murder that has happened on this planet since they have instituted their new system of emotion suppression.
Mm-hmm. And so that when the first issue... I've only read the first issue all the way through, and in that one, there was kind of... She was kind of doing the procedural thing, checking out the body. There were, like, three different... key species moving around on this planet, and they had an interesting interaction. What happens in issue two, maybe without giving away the big stuff?
Well, she's like walking around trying to piece together like all of the evidence that she has so far after chasing a suspect and that suspect getting away. And she sort of like is approaching it, I guess, through a less procedural lens as she's trying to retrace her steps and find out what she's done. So there's a bit more, like, personal anecdotes in here.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there wasn't a ton of personal stuff maybe in the first issue.
Yeah, and it definitely makes her feel like more of a person and less like a crime-solving machine.
Right.
which is good if you're writing a book because you want to relate to the character.
Yep. Although there is a long history of, like, CSI shows that are about crime-solving machines.
You're not wrong.
True.
And, like,
but I guess they do have their quirks.
She definitely did feel a bit like Decker in Blade Runner in the first issue. Just
there,
like,
I suppose there is something of the noir tradition of the detective who's kind of detached morose but detached, and you don't need to know a whole lot about him.
Yeah, but like she's talking about like going on dates and stuff in this book, and like enters into like an actual like dance of death with not to get too cliched, but like a possible suspect, and it's like pretty interesting.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So something interesting. Talk about the art on this book, because the artist is Jamal Campbell is great.
Oh, it's beautiful, and like all the design work is wonderful. Like every single thing looks like fascinating, and I would argue that even if you don't have any interest in reading this type of story, you at least do yourself the service of like flipping through the book and seeing the art.
It looks like some fancy European graphic album.
Oh, totally.
That Mobius has drawn.
And like
Jamal Campbell did Naomi.
I think that's right.
With Bendis and that other guy.
He's worked at Marvel and DC. Has done a few different things. And it's also worth noting the creator of this is a novelist, a sci-fi novelist, Nora K. Jemisin. She's actually been up for the Hugo.
Has won the Hugo.
Oh, she won the Hugo.
Three times, okay. Apparently.
Wow, okay. So she's got several novels, sci-fi novels. She's a former psychologist. Here is a little, I'm looking on Wikipedia. You remember Vox Day, a.k.a. Theodore Beale, the sort of alt-right dude who, like, tried to...
This is one of the ringleader behind trying to, like, doctor the awards.
Yeah, he tried to doctor the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America awards and all that kind of stuff.
I hate all turds who do that.
So during her Guest of Honor speech in 2013, she basically called him out and pointed out that 10% of the membership voted for him in his bid for the presidential position. He then responded by calling her an educated but ignorant savage.
What the... Fuck.
And then he was subsequently expelled from the organization.
Oh, I
so
like
she
it.
Got him booted out of the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, which just makes me love her more.
Oh yeah, that's amazing.
I hope this happened the way it did in one of those 80s movies where he gets drummed out and she punches him like at the end of Die Hard. Like it's just like all the all his snobby racist bullshit like, just got knocked on his ass.
You hope he got Richard Spencer'd?
Yes.
He's like foaming at the mouth and his hair's disheveled while people drag him out and he's rambling like a lunatic.
He's been tased.
And then the people from A Knight's Tale say that he's been found wanting.
Yes. Specifically those actors.
Yeah,
they just run around doing that to people now.
Yes, that would be amazing.
Anyway, just a diversion. But yeah, Far Sector. I like this book too. It's weird and somewhat like cold a little bit, like sci-fi cold, I find it, but interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the second issue is a step up from the coldness of the first issue.
Yeah.
And I think that they were just trying to establish a tone with the story. But I'm not a big fan of Green Lantern.
Yep.
I'm not a big fan of the kind of thing that Green Lantern tends to represent, either.
Except you like Morrison's Green Lantern, right?
I do. That is the only Green Lantern story besides this one that I've liked, and even Grant Morrison's took me a couple issues to get into it.
Maybe you're going to like all Green Lantern from this point forward.
That seems unlikely.
Maybe the Green Lantern switch has been flipped.
That seems unlikely, too.
Green Lantern stuff is very cool for artists to draw when they're really good artists.
Yeah,
I think.
Dave, your pick?
My pick is the first issue of a new D&D miniseries called Dungeons & Dragons Infernal Tides. I've been enjoying all the Jim Zub things, and we've talked about him often in here. He does a mixture of humor and adventure that's a balance I like pretty well for a D&D comic. And this one, by the way, I'm looking at the cover to this, and they've been doing these covers for some of the D&D ones lately. It's a character sheet. The back cover is, too. This is the alt cover, but we've got a number of them at the store. And it's for the favorite character of all of these stories, Minsk, the burly ranger, and his miniature giant space hamster, Boo. it is, I like my fantasy. I tend to like it serious, but D&D kind of often comes with a little bit of side helping of of humor and slight ridiculousness,
yeah,
just based on the way it plays out for people. And so I kind of like these stories. This one has as its backdrop a war in hell. there's a war between the demons, who are kind of like the anarchic metalheads, savaging everything in their path, guys, and the devils, who are like the planners and the manipulators. And there seems to be an artifact on Earth, some kind of a Hellraiser pain box or something that they are after. And the people, some paladins who were trying to guard it and protect it, are being chased by these, like, I don't even know what they are. These kind of like fiery Death Knights type thing.
They were cool looking.
They are cool looking. And the coloring in this was actually particularly nice. I don't know who the artist was, but the coloring is actually Max Dunbar. He's been doing it for a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
But Sebastian Cheng's coloring I really liked. And anyway, these paladins run into our heroes. If this were an actual D&D RPG session, I presume the paladins would be NPCs.
Yep.
Who, in the opening sequence, they're being chased by the demons, and the players have to get together and fight the demons. So yeah, Minsk and Boo are kind of the big goofs, but everybody else in their party is, you know, some degree of a fairly serious character. There's like a priestess of Kelimvor, the death god.
The friendly death god.
The friendly death god. The god of passing over and trying to take people to their fate.
God of death, but in a good way.
Nice death. And then there's some thieves, and it's a good balanced D&D party. And so the mystery continues to unravel. They meet up with an interesting, I'm going to call him an NPC character, who's a guy who deals in artifacts and is kind of in the shady area of morality.
Yeah.
Who was a character I enjoyed quite a bit.
Yep.
But it's clear that they are going to be being pursued by these nasty demons. Nasty enough that even Minsk, with his strength of 18, pretty burly, is like starting to talk some of his goofball trash, and he just gets, strangled by one of them.
Yep.
The first episode sets up all the mysteries. It's just a super fun first issue. There's some plot twisty stuff on the last page. There's little weird winged demon cats. There's all sorts of fun stuff in it.
I'm liking it quite a bit. These are always fun. I've been really liking what Jim Zub's done with the D&D stuff.
They were doing another D&D miniseries, and something must have been happening behind the scenes. The artist was slow, or there was some problem, because it came out so slow that...
And it's still coming out. It's not finished yet.
Right. We all kind of lost track of it, and then they just went ahead, and I think they're like, we just got to start the new one, because these guys can produce.
Also, this ties into the Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus one.
Right.
They just didn't tie in.
Oh, yeah, there was some mention of some...
They might do an Everon book next.
That'd be nice. There's some mention of some group, and this I'm sure is part of the Avernus book or whatever, that like keeps the war between the hell from spilling over onto the mortal planes.
Yeah.
And they're like some benevolent group, the way they've got like the Harpers in the Forgotten Realm, but like specifically for containing demons and stuff. And I was like, oh man, that sounds cool. I want to play that campaign and join up with their anti-devil demon group.
Maybe you need to read the Descent into Avernus hardcover that's on sale now at Rogues Gallery.
Oh, where would I find Rogues Gallery?
Go to Google, man. What's wrong with you?
1601 South IH 35 Suite 330.
If anyone's listening to this podcast and doesn't know where our store is, I'm a little weirded out.
I don't know. Maybe they've got listening on a ham radio. some kids listening 70s? In the Philippines in the 1970s is picking up this because of tachyon particles.
Wow.
Oh. Invest in apple.com. Trust me. Okay.
Randy, what do you have?
My
to
pick
offer?
Is Star Trek Voyager Mirrors and Smoke.
A close pick for me, too.
Which is weird because I have seen maybe 3 episodes of Star Trek Voyager.
Yep.
And I didn't like it. It's not one of my favorite Star Treks. Yeah, I didn't like the old Star Trek.
You can't
Voyager.
Just. I do think like if you just watch the first 3 or something, or even maybe 3 random ones, it may not necessarily catch you. Well,
especially if you were watching it as I was after having come off Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, when Next Generation had this really solid ending, Deep Space Nine was getting into its like heavy Dominion War stuff, and then Voyager's doing stuff like take the cheese to sick bay. Like their early stories are not great.
You're not wrong.
I don't even know what you're talking about. Take the cheese to sick bay.
It was one of the big stories in like the episode where some kind of contaminated cheese was causing problems. I don't know. It's a weird show.
Anne and I have been watching it for the last year off and on, and by the place we're at, which is around season 4-ish, there's like lots of good stuff going on.
That's what I heard.
Just keep it in mind. But clearly you liked this, which is their Mirror Universe version.
Yeah, so the Mirror Universe, this reminds me exactly what happened with Next Generation when I saw the Mirror Universe stuff. I'm like, oh, it's a fresh take on a universe that I always like in theory. Mm-hmm. And the pitch here is that Janeway and her crew, when they get shot across into the Delta Quadrant where it's unfamiliar, she becomes a pirate queen. And decides to become the pirate queen of the Delta Quadrant.
Right, because this is contemporary with the stuff that we saw from the Mirror Universe in DS9, where we learned that the Cardassian-Klingon Alliance has basically crushed the also equally evil human racist empire, the Terran Empire.
Yeah.
So she's like, oh, I'm out of there. Yeah. I could just go and become like this freebooter.
Yep. And so she has a sort of rivalry with a fellow pirate that was in the Delta Quadrant, Neelix, and his powerful telekinetic girlfriend Kez.
Yep.
Yeah. Is that a thing? Did she have powers?
Yeah.
I didn't know any of that.
It took like a few seasons before they really brought it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's clear that she would have like honed it, and it made her like much more dangerous in this one.
Yeah, I was gonna say without empathy, she probably would have developed it as a weapon.
Exactly.
It picks up with them teleporting they find a rare human life sign on this shuttlecraft. They teleport Annika Hansen aboard, which is a name I didn't know, but you can tell from the very beautiful painted art that this is Seven of Nine pre-Borging.
Yes.
And somehow she is brought aboard. She's a mystery. She's sent to sickbay to talk with the doctor. Things start going awry aboard the ship. There are, as in all Mirror Universe stories, there's insurrections and political maneuverings. Odd allies.
I feel there's like three or four factions vying in this one.
Oh, yeah.
And it's always super fun in these Mirror Universe ones to watch them stab each other's backs.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's really fun. I love their reveal of who the bad guy is. I love the way they deal with it. I love smart, aggressive Janeway. I also love, this is the thing they did in Next Generation Mirror Universe. Apparently, the way you become captain in the Mirror Universe is you tear off your shirt sleeves and you get huge guns.
Yeah, and Janeway looks great.
I love it.
With huge guns.
Well, J.K. Woodward is the artist who's been doing the best Mirror Universe artwork. He did the Star Trek Next Generation Mirror Universe stuff, and his designs are great. They look like what I would have like hoped that the TNG crew would have looked like in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
Honestly, it probably looks better than they would have had they done it in the 80s. So, but it still fits the visual aesthetic of the stuff, and this fits the aesthetic of Voyager. But I think also kind of betters it a little bit because he's probably a more fashionable guy than some of their fashion designers.
Yeah, I'll say this also. I think that this is a one shot, but it does close with a very good sort of cliffhanger ending, and it says the end ? I really hope it's not. I hope this does as well as the other Mirror Universe, because I want more of this. Which is interesting, because like I said, I had no interest in this. The only reason I read this is because I love the Mirror Broken series so much. These guys, and this is a different writer. Paul Allor is the writer, and I think he's been doing Year 5, maybe?
Maybe so.
He's not the brothers or whatever that are always working on.
Yeah, the Tiptons.
But it's really good. I think if you're a Voyager fan, you're going to especially love it. There's probably references I didn't quite get, but...
Yeah, there's some fun insider stuff in there.
It's super fun, and I liked it a lot.
Out of curiosity, maybe you can answer this. Why did Tom Paris have a stutter in the book?
I was not sure. I don't know if that showed up at some other point, or if it was... I got the impression it was just made to, like, kind of make him look meek, in
that
a way.
Did he and Kim swap
roles?
Or maybe like, he was a mining slave and this one got beaten or something.
You know what I could also see? It's something that they want to do in a second story and reveal it there.
I was going to suggest that perhaps it was because he was a Maquis and that the Maquis played a different role, but Chakotay is also in this like karate kicking a dude out of an airlock.
Like you do.
All right, so Nick, why don't you give us your pick for the week?
Well, it's another week, so it's another mutant book.
Uh-huh.
This one is X-Force number 3, which was... You know, all the books of the X-Books are all about creating new villains and sort of new problems for the X-Men.
Because everybody's a good guy now.
Everybody's a good guy now. So they had to come up with new ones, or at least use human bad guys and machine bad guys.
Right.
But X-Force seems to be carrying that weight a little bit better than most of the other books. Not that I... say that the other books have problems, but I think I like the villains in X-Force a little bit more than all the other ones, because they're kind of super scary.
They're very dark.
I mean, they're essentially the Reavers, but they're, like, utilizing new technologies to build, like, these super soldiers that are, you know, created from machine parts and all this other stuff. So, it's creepy. Benjamin Percy, which I'm not a big fan of, honestly.
Yeah, I know you're not a fan of most of the stuff.
But he's finding a good, like, middle ground here with balancing kind of new threats, but also doing some back and forth between characters that maybe we've seen before, but maybe we haven't. Like, there's been a back and forth between Wolverine and Quentin Quire, which I know Anna has been very pleased with, which I think is an interesting pairing. And then, of course, you're dealing with the death of Xavier and Jean Grey kind of stepping up and things like that. So I've just enjoyed every issue of this even more so.
We're about three issues in on all the books at this point, right?
Yep.
Do you have a favorite of the line?
Marauders is still my favorite.
Okay, all right.
It's
same.
Anna, you as well?
Oh, yeah, same.
It's just that fun balance of fun while telling interesting stories. And plus, the last issue was all about Sebastian Shaw, and I'm fine with that.
Are there any of them that you are not feeling so much?
Fallen Angels is still kind of at the bottom. I like what it's done so far, but it's meandering a little bit too much for me.
Anna?
I think that one is also the one that has the least, like, identity.
Okay, all right.
And that could be just Quanon as maybe not the most interesting character in all the world.
Well, also, she struggles with identity.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. So. Yeah, and that's built into the character, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right, Nick, what else is on your stack?
There's a couple more X-books. So there was also an issue of New Mutants, which meanders away from the traditional New Mutants and onto some of the lesser-known members of, like, Generation X and the Hellions and...
Oh, interesting.
So we get Armor and Glob and a few of the other smaller characters.
And?
Morrison's...
Some characters from New X-Men.
Yeah. We got Beak and...
Angel.
Angel. Which
cool.
Was kind of a cool callback.
Yeah.
And, again, this is throwing a new threat at the New Mutants and sort of the young people and what they're having to deal with in this day and age, which I thought was interesting.
Is the threat Boomer Mutants?
I mean,
no, but Boom Boom does show up.
The thing that I like about X-Force specifically, and also, I guess, the creation of these new X-Men villains is, like, while sure that the characters like Apocalypse and stuff have done super bad things in the past, it feels, like, really weird to have your, like, minority analog characters fighting each other and not, you know,
the
racists or the system or homophobes or what have you as the opposition metaphor. So I like that about this.
Okay. What else?
Fallen Angels number 3, which more and more about the new god, Apoth, that Quanon is tasked with destroying. Other things on my list, Frank Miller comes back with another iteration of The Dark Knight Returns, this one titled The Golden Child. I did not get a chance to read this. I did thumb through it because it has spectacular artwork by Raphael Grandpa.
Raphael Grandpa's amazing.
Yeah, his design work is so good. And there is a female Supergirl, it looks like, in this.
A female Supergirl?
Well, like she looks like Superboy, like the 90s Superboy, but she's kind of like... I don't know. It's a really good design. And actually, I think the Batgirl or Batwoman design is really good, too. It's just a fun... He's a good designer.
Yeah.
If you've never seen the Daredevil he created just randomly...
Oh, yeah.
That Daredevil is amazing. There is a book called Harley Quinn's Villain of the Year, which is a fun little one-off about the villains giving an award for the best villain of the year. It's a silly idea. Done... fairly well.
Okay.
Second issue of Dollhouse Family, which is the Black Label, Joe Hill, Mike Carey, Peter Gross book.
Uh-huh.
Continues to be creepy. It continues to be Mike Carey-ish. So if you really like him and the way he tells stories, which is sort of meandering through time.
Yeah.
It's perfect. It's creepy. Then I don't know if you guys picked this or not.
Dave picked that one.
Okay.
D&D Infernal.
Yeah. I will reiterate that D&D Infernal Tides was hilarious.
Super fun. Yeah.
I love Minsk. Jim Zub has got a great handle on those characters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I actually like all the other characters he's created, too. There's some cool little... they're dwarf... they're not, like, rogues, but they're kind of rogues.
Yeah.
Who kind of go through the city, which are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then Superman 18, which I have not been reading Superman, but this is a big issue.
Yes.
And
it's not a spoiler. It's on the cover.
Yeah. He basically reveals his secret identity to the world.
Because Bendis doesn't believe in secret identities.
And I'm actually okay with this one. I know we talked about it a couple of months back when it was first revealed. The issue is actually really good. There are some scenes in here. While Bendis doesn't do, like, the greatest story in all the world, he does have a knack for telling scenes. Yeah. And the scene specifically with him and Perry White, revealing, because he reveals himself to him, like, personally, it's touching and really, really good. It's an interesting story. I will be curious to see the ramifications.
Anna, what else is on your stack?
What else is on my stack? I had all three of the X-Books, which I enjoyed. I had Dr. Mirage, which...
Valiant book?
Yeah, Magdalene Visaccio is writing, and wonderful.
We should be coming up and trade that pretty soon.
Yeah, I think this might be the very last issue. I'm pretty sure it ends with Dr. Mirage will return.
Okay.
So, but yeah, like, the art in it is beautiful, and it's, like, sort of a through the lens of a superhero story, a tale about, like, processing death and loss.
Okay.
And it's, like really touching and super cool to see, like, sort of the beautiful, like, trippy visuals, like, what I would have liked to see in a Doctor Strange movie, almost. I have Rat Queens, which I'm really enjoying the sort of, like, passing of the torch between the creator and this current writer. It had a rocky couple of issues to start, but it's, like, really fallen into, like, a good mixture of, like, pop culture with D&D humor, giving, like, a...
That's
like
good to hear. I miss Rat Queens. I might need to go back to it.
Yeah, it vibes really well. I feel definitely like I'm watching, like, I don't know, maybe the female cast members of Saturday Night Live playing D&D. Like, that's how their interactions play out there.
I'd watch that.
Yeah. So, I have the Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy book, which, I wish it was more, but I'm enjoying it still enough that I'm picking it up. Something is killing the children.
Something is killing the children.
I still don't know what it is, but I am told that it is something. but no, seriously, this book is also wonderful. Jane Foster Valkyrie, also wonderful. Vampirella Red Sonja. I'll read anything with Red Sonja in it, but this book has been a delight, actually.
You feel about Red Sonja the way I feel about Hawkeye.
It's true.
And I feel about Red Sonja the way you feel about Hawkeye.
You do? I'm so hurt.
Now you know how I feel. You make fun of my favorite archer.
I'm sorry.
Second favorite archer.
Who's your first favorite archer?
Archer. No, Green Arrow. Sean Archer from the movie Face Off.
Oh, wow.
No.
That is not what I expected.
No, it's Green Arrow. It's Hawkeye and Green Arrow are tied. Uh-huh. And then, I guess, other archers, like Archer from the show Archer and Sean Archer from
I can't think of any other archers.
There's probably some other archers.
I'm sure.
Robin Hood's
okay.
Well, Katniss. You already said you liked Green Arrow.
Yes, I do.
Katniss from The Hunger Games. She was an archer.
Oh, yeah, I like Katniss. Katniss is great.
Randy, what is on your stack?
So Dave wanted us to mention, since he had to rotate out, that Red Mother from Boom is an interesting first issue where a woman basically loses an eye in a violent incident, gets a new eye, and starts seeing weird demonic stuff. It's got nice art, interesting character stuff, and it's worth checking out. Punisher Soviet number 2 is Frank talking with the Russian Punisher, basically. He's a guy who's been going around killing people. We find out why. He's got a more specific mission. It's good bro bonding between two mercenary killers. It's the kind of thing that Garth Ennis does well.
I was going to say, that sounds
and it's,
right up Ennis'
he's
alley.
He's super in love with the special ops. This guy's former special ops in Afghanistan. He's drawing parallels between Afghanistan and Vietnam. It's Garth Ennis doing what Garth Ennis does. It's a solid Punisher. I kind of enjoyed it. 7 Days number 3 is more of Gail Simone's like apocalyptic superhero story with a humanistic approach. I'm actually really liking this. It makes me want to see more of this universe. Undiscovered number 2 is more of that weird sci-fi fantasy.
It's bonkers.
It is bonkers. It reminds me of East of West. But that was kind of fun. Curious to see where that goes. Tom Taylor finishes up his Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man with issue number 14. I guess that's the tail end of his run. With a nice sort of emotional issue where Peter has to be waiting for May to get out of her cancer surgery. And basically the city goes dark and he has to decide whether to wait for her or to go out and protect the city. He does what you would expect him to do, but there's a little twist to it, and it's a nice, heartwarming touch, the kind of thing Tom Taylor does well. Immortal Hulk is... Banner has gotten himself a hold of Hulk Base and is basically now using it to commit social justice actions against the evil Roxxon Corporation, which is run by a Minotaur.
Sick.
And there's a security guard for Roxxon who is mad that his teenage daughter is joining up with these teenage Hulks. It is a strange, weird, really entertaining book.
Minotaur has actually been running Roxxon for quite some time.
Yeah, yeah. That was the... and Exxon, weirdly. I don't know if you guys know that. In the real world, a Minotaur runs Exxon.
Well, that was a Jason Aaron character.
Why? Wasn't he in his Jane Foster's
He is, yeah.
Run? Yeah.
Dying is Easy, which is a Joe Hill mystery book. It's a nice sort of painty artwork that reminds me of Ben Templesmith's stuff. If you're like noir, maybe check that out. And then there's two things from last week. Basketful of Heads number 2, which is Joe Hill's Hill House Comics, and Die number 10, which I've been enjoying that book quite a bit.
It's so good.
That issue especially took a twist.
All right, we got a few minutes left, so real quick, let's talk about Knives Out.
Like, get your knives out right now?
Yes, get our knives out.
Mine's in my purse.
Yeah, of course you have knives.
Do you not?
No, I don't. I don't have knives on me at all times.
Obviously, well, I don't either.
I have a blade within reach.
Yeah, there's swords.
I hate to tell you, Nick, that is not a knife. That is like 3 feet long.
It could be a knife.
For a giant, maybe.
Nick's very tall.
Sure.
Yeah, but not Anna and Elsa tall.
No, he's not 11 feet tall. So, Knives Out. We're going to spoil. If you have not seen, please do not listen to this. Just go see Knives Out. It is definitely in my favorite movies of the year.
Yeah.
I think we all saw it in different... Nick saw it first. He saw it in a sneak peek.
Yep.
I saw it and saw it twice. Anna just saw it.
Yeah, I saw it on Sunday.
And we all love it.
I need to see it again because when I watched it, there was a person dying next to me.
Oh.
Just like...
Did you stab them with your knife?
Yes.
Well, that's why they were dying.
I know, but I was going on brand.
That's fair. I mean, I can't... people don't really get into the movies enough, and that's appreciated. Yeah.
All kidding aside, this is a great movie. Rian Johnson, I think... This is probably my favorite Rian Johnson film.
It's this or Brothers Bloom. And I feel like anyone who sees this and likes it should see Brothers Bloom.
But I think Brothers Bloom is very good. I think I like this cast more than I like...
The cast in this is so good.
Yeah.
Don Johnson kind of steals every scene he's in.
He does.
He's terrible.
But... For the wrong reasons. His character is awful.
But Don Johnson is on it like a kick nowadays.
He's playing likable racists?
Yep. He does have a theme, doesn't he?
You really don't want to get typecast for that, though.
But, I mean, Django Unchained?
Oh, my God. Likable racist is...
Is kind of his brand. Come a long way since... Yeah. What is Don Johnson best known for?
Miami Vice.
Okay, yeah, that's
right. Or Nash Bridges.
Nash Bridges. Yeah, I did watch some Nash Bridges.
Which, I mean, it was the 80s. They were probably racist, too.
And he himself, about cops, though, did not.
As well.
Yeah, he was cops.
You can cut that if you want.
Why would I? it's about the murder of this sort of big mystery author... who's written all these whodunit books.
Played by Christopher Plummer,
and he's great.
Yep.
And then we see this investigation, which is, it's like a week later, the police are going to rule it a suicide, but there's this mysterious private eye, this charismatic southern private eye who's been hired by a mysterious benefactor to look into it, and he believes it's a murder, and that one of the family did it, and so they start asking questions, and through a series of flashbacks, we see that there's been a lot of drama going on, and that maybe the will was changed, and I love the way this all rolled out, because I was watching it guessing, as I'm leaning over the person, I'm like, he's not really dead, this is all a fake out, he's playing a game, and then it's like, when you see it, I'm like, oh no, that guy's dead. Yeah, like, that guy's definitely dead. Well, I don't know what's going on at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a great flip with Chris Evans, where you're like, oh, well, he's playing this, he's having fun playing a douchebag, and then you're like, oh no, he's actually got a heart of gold. He's helping. He's the guy. He's help. Oh no, he's not.
He's a douchebag.
Yep. Like, I loved all the reversals. I loved every character. I thought Toni Collette's Gwyneth Paltrow impression in particular was delightful.
Yeah, really good. The girl from 13 Reasons Why. I can never remember her actual name.
Oh yeah,
is that the daughter?
Yeah, she was Toni Collette's daughter. Yeah. She was great in it. Sort of the one person who was nice to the main character of the film.
And the main character's great.
Sort of.
Nice-ish, yeah. Well, she shells her out the second her own...
Nicer than all the other racists.
Yes.
Nice until her own fortunes are threatened, at which point she turns on her immediately and then feels bad about it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that might be a political commentary, but
a million times better than Michael Shannon, who goes to her apartment.
Oh, my God.
Wow, that was such a great little scene, because it's, like, it's threatening, but at the same time pathetic.
So yes. Michael Shannon is an actor who, whenever I see him, whenever he's on screen, I'm always wondering, when's he going to fucking explode?
Yeah.
Because I've never seen him, like, play bumbling before, and he's definitely bumbling in the movie up until that point, and then he is very menacing.
Yeah.
So that took me by surprise.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was going to say specifically about him is that I love his, like, argument with Don Johnson in the room where they're just, like, sort of, like, slapping each other and, like, very silly.
Yeah, there's such ineffective machismo going on between the two of them.
Also, again, probably another political commentary where they're, like, he's like, my son's very politically active, and everyone's like, oh, his son is a literal Nazi.
He's a piece of shit.
And he's like, I don't know what that means. Never heard of those before. Yeah. What's that?
Yeah.
I love that his son is basically on his phone the entire
time.
Time.
Oh, yeah. He's barely there.
Yeah, he's barely there.
Yeah.
Though he is the cause of the best line in the movie.
Yeah, one of the best lines. So let's talk about, I mean, James Bond.
Daniel Craig
is fantastic here as this, like, Southern Belle detective.
Yep.
He's wonderful.
He comes off, it's a very Columbo-type detective. He comes off as, like, bumbling. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's just kind of got this weird accent.
It's Hercule Poirot.
It's presenting himself as this ineffective, not a threat, to lure people in so that he's got the whole thing figured out from the beginning. And he's just trying to put the pieces together. But he also has these great turns of phrase, like when he's talking about the case being a donut, and he's like, and we found a donut hole, but the hole wasn't a hole, it was another donut with a hole in it. And it's like, it's hilarious to see him, like, spin.
Yeah, one of my favorite little scenes is him sitting in the car when the main character runs into it, and he's just kind of listening to music, singing to himself. You can tell he's having fun on the set.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he just chews the scenery, and he got a Golden Globe nomination.
He should get an Oscar nod. Also, I like that despite the fact that he is this sort of accomplished detective, he's not Sherlock. He's not like an asshole.
Yeah, no.
He is, in fact, very touched by the sort of kindness of the protagonist. Like, he knew her involvement from the outset. And he doesn't, like, go after her. He's like, let's figure out what happened because this doesn't fit with what I see of her.
Yeah.
I thought that was really good.
He's, in fact, the kind of nicest person in the entire movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say he's the only person who does not treat her like garbage, like,
from the get-go. Christopher Plummer didn't.
Christopher Plummer doesn't.
You're right. But he's not really in the... I mean, he is in the movie, but he's not alive in the movie.
Yeah. That's true. And was it Lakeith Stanfield?
Lakeith Stanfield does not get a lot to do, but he's funny.
No, he is funny.
Yeah.
That was one of the detectives?
He's the guy from Get Out. And,
okay, that's what I thought.
I do love the fanboyishness of the other guy, where he's like, from this book and this book.
Yep.
Like, that was great. And the big reveal at the end with Chris Evans where he goes for the knife. And oh, man, there's so many great little moments.
I was just going to say, what I do love about this is I think when you're telling a mystery story, it's, like, all too easy to not give the audience the information that they need to figure it out themselves.
Yeah.
And when I watch movies like this, I like to sit there and try to piece things together.
Uh-huh.
But, like, I love it when they give you the tools to call the twist, like, at the outset. Like, one of the very first lines of the movie is Christopher Plummer says, you lose the ability to tell the difference between a prop and a real knife.
Yep.
And I thought that it was so cool. I mean, it was Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah.
So it was just so cool.
Yeah. One of the things that this is shifting gears a little bit, but Damon Lindelof talks about in the Watchmen podcast is how he's like, I got to play fair with the audience. Like, I don't want you to figure out my story, but I don't want you to not figure out because I didn't give you the tools to do it. That's not fair.
Yeah.
And I feel like Rian Johnson got the heart of the whodunit, which is, if you're really paying attention, you might be able to predict what happened here. And certainly, you can be a little bit ahead of what's going on. Like, oh, that happens. That must mean this. So this must be this. And if you're this certain kind of person, which I kind of am when I'm watching these, I love being just ahead of it. But I love it even more when I'm just ahead of part of it, but I haven't guessed all of it. And that's what this did for me. Like, I had figured some of the things, but I didn't know who did it. I didn't know what the story, what the twist was going to be.
I was just enjoying.
And it's fun. It's smart. It's really funny.
You can tell he loves
biting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. You can tell he loves the genre, too. I mean, I've heard a couple of interviews with him about the making of this and his just kind of expounding on his love for kind of the whodunit and Agatha Christie. And he grew up watching those movies based on those and a couple of other things. I need to seek out some of the movies he liked because they sounded interesting.
Yeah. I would love to see more Benoit Blanc mysteries.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
There's
talk of it.
Yeah, there's talk of
and
it.
And they certainly, the tickets have been, it's done really, really well.
Well, it beat out Frozen 2, I think, or something for the Thanksgiving weekend.
More Knives, maybe you would have a better movie.
Maybe not Frozen 2. It took out Ford versus Ferrari, which I think a lot of people were thinking they would win over the holiday.
Take that, Ford versus Ferrari, marry more knives in your car, and you would have
it's true, there were no knives in the car, but...
all right. That about does it for us this week. We'll be back hopefully next week with more. We're going to be going on hiatus pretty soon just for holiday stuff, but we're hoping to get one more episode before the end of the year. And until that time,
Yo, Joe.
Or
Battle on Xena.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.